And with that, with those great introductions, let's start. Okay, so I think there's a lot to talk about tonight. I'm going to try to keep it shorter than last week, where we went past my intended hour. And we talked about what the topic of, I'll use my prepubescent voice, today I become a man. Which, it's the one time you're ever going to hear me say that. The fascinating development of bar and bat mitzvah in Jewish life. So there's something so absurd about the idea of a bar and bat mitzvah, at least the way that it's framed in, by ourselves or our kids. I take off my sweater as we learn. The concept that you can turn 12 or 13 years old, and we'll talk about where those ages come from, and somehow magically be transformed to a Jewish adult. I don't know. To me, it strikes me as a little bit insane, to put it lightly. How can a 12 or 13-year-old be viewed as a full adult in Jewish society? So that's some of what we're going to talk about. But also, the whole pomp and circumstance around bar and bat mitzvah, where did it come from? What's the origin of it? What's the purpose of it? You know, why do we spend time, effort, torturing our young ones to practice their Torah readings and get their drashot into good shape? And then for the introverts especially, forcing them to get up in front of a crowd and talk in front of hundreds of people, like, what's the point of it all? Why does it matter? And where does it come from? So that's part one that we're going to talk about. So the first part's really going to be oriented mostly on bar mitzvahs. And then part two, what we're going to talk about is what I think a fascinating case study in American Orthodoxy. And you could apply some of the principles from Orthodox, from this case to a lot of other issues that affect the Orthodox world, and particularly how Orthodoxy interacts with modernity. Because bat mitzvah, as it's currently celebrated, is not something that was done 100 years ago in Europe. It's not something that was even being done 100 years ago in America. And so how did that develop? How did it start? I don't know if you're familiar, but it was actually extremely controversial in the Orthodox world for a long time. I just spoke to one of our older members. I'm going to take that back. I just spoke to one of our longtime members, who's not an older member, who grew up in the synagogue, and I asked her if she had a bat mitzvah at Beth Jacob. And this would have probably been in the early 60s, I'm guessing. I'll tell you who it is after, when we're not on record. And she said that her older sister had had one, her brother had had a bar mitzvah, but she didn't actually have one for different reasons. I was just trying to get a sense, like, what was Beth Jacob doing when you were growing up? Jerry, you were here? Yeah. Were girls having bat mitzvahs?
No.
Okay.
Not at all.
So we're going to see why were they not having bat mitzvahs, and when did that change? So that's part two. So let's dig right in. What's the origin of bar and bat mitzvah? Oh, I'll just add one more anecdote. In terms of what our bar and bat mitzvahs look like nowadays, I think at some point 10 years ago, Rabbi Darda gave a big drash about not spending too much money on bar and bat mitzvahs, if I'm not mistaken. I've come from other communities where people can spend more than a house on a bar and bat mitzvah, just in terms of like everyone trying to outprice each other, out-kiddish each other, keeping up with the Joneses on steroids, I guess keeping up with the Cohens on steroids. So I remember, Barak, just give me one second, a conversation I had with my father, who was raised Jewish but not specifically observant. And I was getting ready for my bar mitzvah, so probably in that very high voice, you know, Dad, why is it that I have to, you know, I have to, my brother and I were twins. We were splitting our Torah reading, and then I was doing the Haftorah. He was going to pray Musaf. And it was this big thing in our family. And I asked him, like, what did you do when you were bar mitzvahed? And he said, well, I think I came to a synagogue on a Thursday morning. I got an aliyah. There was sponge cake and schnapps. The adults made a l'chaim, and then I went to school.
And herring.
Herring. Maybe. And hopefully in Montreal there's at least some herring. So it wasn't a big deal. Right? And so where does this custom of having a big celebratory meal develop from also? We're going to touch on that as well. So, did someone want to say something?
Is it supposed to be as big as a wedding, though?
We're going to see. Okay, that's a good point. Maybe it should be as big as a wedding. But then that begs the question, how big should weddings be also? So that's a different conversation.
It seems like nowadays the parties are played down much more than when I was bar mitzvah or my kids were bar mitzvah.
Okay.
Which is not that long ago.
Yeah.
The Saturday night party you know, after mm-hmm. Shabbat, the rooms upstairs were always used.
Oh, interesting.
But nowadays,
yeah,
the parties are usually for the kids and not a big event like
yeah.
they were years ago.
If you're looking at the Bay Area, you're not looking
right.
at LA and New York.
Well, I'm talking about this.
Yeah.
I remember the first bat mitzvah I ever went to was at the Montreal Ritz-Carlton. And I had never even heard of the Ritz-Carlton. And it was a culture shock, to say the least. But yes, there's something to that. So the first source we're going to have to look at is the way that the rabbis basically thought of the timeline of life. How are we supposed to spend our entire lives? And this is probably a source that some people here are familiar with before. So I'm going to read this first source in Hebrew because it's significant. And the translation does it some fairness. So this is Rabbi Yehuda ben Tema, one of the authors of the Mishnah. He says this in Pirkei Avot, Ethics of Our Fathers, that ben chamesh shanim lemikra, when a person becomes 5 years old, that's time for reading. And mikra, though, is synonymous in the Mishnah with reading the Torah, the five books of Moses. Happens to be that there's a yeshiva nowadays in Jerusalem, the Zilberman's yeshiva, that follows this principle. And at 5 years old, they start getting the young boys to memorize the Torah. By the time they're 13, some of them memorize the five books of Moses. And not only do they memorize the words, they memorize the cantillation also. So they could by heart read you the entire Torah. It's one of the craziest things I've ever heard. Pedagogically, it's like a question, right? If you're just forcing kids to cram information in their minds, how much space is left in there for critical thinking? Anyway, separate pedagogical question. You can ask Alana what she thinks later. Any expert educators in the room, Allison, you can let us know your thoughts. But that's based on this Mishnah that when you turn 5, you should start learning Chumash, the five books of Moses. Okay, then Esther the Mishnah. When you turn 10, you should start studying Mishnah. Okay, so Mishnah are the six orders that talk about all the different categories of Jewish law. They were compiled in 200 of the Common Era by Rabbi Yehuda Levi, and it's probably the at the time this is the most distilled, concentrated Jewish law that was existent at the point. And it's the summation of the oral tradition of the oral Torah. Okay. Next up, Bein Shlosh Esrei LeMitzvot. When there's a son, when you're a child, or here it's Ben, a boy of 13, is now has reached the age of mitzvot, reached the age of the commandments. So before you're 13, are 12-year-old boys supposed to do mitzvot? What's the status of a 12-year-old or an 11-year-old or a 10-year-old? So clearly when you turn 13 here, you're supposed to do all the mitzvot. But before that, what's the status?
Father's responsibility.
Parents' responsibility, okay. Great. Or father's responsibility.
I still do mitzvot. Obviously.
Right, so we
but
know...
But you're not obligated to do mitzvot.
Right, so intuitively we know this, right? Like my 4-year-old daughter, right, I try to get her to make kiddush, right, to light Shabbat candles, try to get her to make her brachas, etc. I want her to do mitzvot. But the Talmud is very clear that until a boy at least turns 13... everything that they do before that is the mitzvah of chinuch, is the mitzvah of education, right? So pre-13 is about training, and the day you turn 13 is when it becomes the real deal, right? Is when you actually take responsibility for the actions themselves. So the Talmud debates what age does a person arrive at chinuch, at being subject to education. And there seems to be some debate, but some poskim say it depends on what the mitzvah is. It's really at what point can they identify with the meaning of the mitzvah or the basic idea. When it comes to blessings and prayer, some of the poskim say, I believe based on the Gemara, that they have to be able to understand the concept of God before they can start praying to that God. So there's something to that. In any case, nowadays, we try to just have them memorize as much as possible so that when they do start to understand the concepts, that they can just plug and play. But in any case, before 13, it's about education. And once a boy hits 13, it's about actually doing the mitzvot, being responsible for them in the scheme of their adult lives as Jews. Are they fully responsible at 13? What do we think? Can a 13-year-old be fully responsible for every mitzvah?
Well, I don't know how lucky it is, but the answer is no.
Okay, so we know, right, developmentally, we know that most 13-year-olds are not really fully responsible. The Talmud's actually sensitive to this. The Gemara says that until a person turns 20, they're obligated in the mitzvot, but they're not responsible for the punishments, which is interesting. So a Beit Din would not give any 18-year-old at least not capital punishment or not corporeal punishment until they would turn 20. So it's interesting, there's a sensitivity there that you're kind of in a gray zone, right? You need to do it, but if you don't fully do it, we hold you to a different standard. It's almost like you can imagine juvenile court, right? You can't get away with anything, everything, but the level of punishment is different. So, okay, we'll leave that for now. So then the Mishnah goes on and on, and until you get to 20, it seems to be very practical. Ben Chamesh Esrei LeTalmud, when you turn 15, you don't only study the Mishnah, now you study the Talmudic commentaries on the Mishnah. So all the back and forths. Let me just ask, can we open a few windows? Because I... that one's a little bit open. Thank you. Thanks, Baraka. Awesome. So if you pick it up a little more, maybe just turn the wood up. Perfect. And we'll get a bit of a cross breeze. Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, Jeff.
So you say you're obligated at 13 or you're obligated at 20?
You're obligated at 13, but you're not held fully responsible for your mistakes until you're 20. Okay, so 15 is studying Talmud. Shmona Esrei is chuppah, time to get married, according to the Mishnah. So the Rambam, parenthetically, the Rambam takes issue with this Mishnah and disagrees with it, Maimonides. Maimonides says, and I think the dads in the room might agree with this, that you shouldn't get married until you are able to support your family. There's probably an entire community of Jews in Israel and elsewhere whose parents wish that they were supporting their families. It's one of the most interesting phenomenons in modern Jewish sociology, which is that there's an entire community in the Haredi world where parents are supporting children and now even grandchildren. Sorry?
Wives are supporting
husbands. Wives are supporting husbands to study, right, in kolels, and parents and grandparents are supporting children and grandchildren as they study in kolel, sometimes for extended periods of time.
Not to be too... difficult about this, but as I read this, it doesn't say 18 that you should get married when you're 18.
It says that
you should get married from the time you're 18 on, just like all these others are from the time that time on.
Yeah. So that's a good question. Is this a guiding principle? Right? Is this like are these the laws or are these, let's say, the principles or the road markers?
Right.
Okay. That's a fair reading of it. Let's just continue. Now, it's clear from 20 on, the Mishnah gets much more abstract. Okay, so from 20, it's time lirdof, to chase or to pursue. What does that mean? I don't know. It's the time where people get out in life and try to start running after things. Okay, when you turn 30, koach, strength. What does that mean? I don't know. Maybe you're a little more confident. Maybe you feel like you've learned a little bit about life. Okay, when you're 40, bina. Bina is a specific kind of wisdom. 40, etza, advice. When you turn 50, you're starting to be able to give advice to others. Shishim, 60. That's at 50. That was at 50. And Steve, I'm happy to send you the sources after if you'd like to look at them.
I would.
When you turn 60, zikna. Zikna means you've achieved old age. Shivim l'seva. Seva is kind of an old age wisdom at 70. Shmonim l'gvura. 80 is heroism or... heroism, strength, like added strength. Tishim asuach, that's a complicated one. When you arrive at 90, the translation here is you start to bend over. Okay, I know some people who do that at an earlier age also. Yeah, and weird end of the Mishnah. Ben mea, when a person turns 100, ki'ilu meit, it's as if they have died, v'avaru batal min olam, and they have kind of ceased and stopped existing in the world. Which I think it's an interesting observation that as people achieve very old age, it becomes harder and harder to be present with the world around them. Right? Their lives often become smaller at a certain point, especially in that older age. You can imagine the Mishnah was written in 200, the Common Era. There were not a lot of people who made it to 100 back then.
Yeah, I was just going to say in the context of when it was written, people weren't living to 100, except those in my Bible.
Right, but that was even earlier. Yeah, that's a great point. So so we have this kind of timeline of a human life, and whether it's just guideposts or whether it's actually some strict expectation, I don't think there's any evidence that everyone would get married at 18 back in the day. We know in Mishnaic times and Talmudic times that there was this whole process when on the 15th of Av, the daughters of Jerusalem would go dancing out in the fields and they would kind of try to impress potential suitors by dancing in white borrowed garments, topic for another time. So it's not like this was, at least the marriage part was adhered to super strictly, but it was certainly a recommendation. We know people did get married a lot younger, not just in the Jewish world, in general. So there's more to talk about that, but we're going to zoom in today on that one line of Ben Shlosh Esrei L'mitzvot. When you turn 13, it's time for your commandments. It's time for your mitzvot. Where does that come from? Where is the Mishnah basing itself on, that 13 is some magical number? Well, 13, some people think, is a good luck number. If you're a Christian architect living in the early 1900s, and high-rises are starting to be built, you probably think it's an unlucky number, and so you pretend like your buildings don't have any. Right. Yeah, Baraka.
Doesn't 13 mean like transition number two? Like that's probably why people have like the year of it, because it's like the year of change.
Oh, interesting.
Some people say like it's like the year of like you're transitioning, like you're entering this new era of your new self. They say it's like,
yeah.
Some people feel like taboo because they have a fear of change. That's why they have like no 13 floor. But I was told in the ancient African tradition, we visualize 13 as like a new age of like new beginnings of like. Something to be proud of. Like, if you're 13, so it's like, oh, you're almost there. For like, it's age, like, when it's age, oppressive,
oh, cool.
Like, it's like a proud, it's like, oh my God, I'm almost a man, like, I'm 13.
Yeah,
I'm
interesting.
One step closer to like, become a man to us and everything.
Right, that's interesting. Well, yeah, Jay was just saying that Yishmael was circumcised when he was 13 years old. So that number does come up earlier. An interesting midrash bases the idea of bar mitzvah on an odd moment, actually a difficult moment in Genesis, which is after Dinah is captured and raped by the prince of Shechem. Her brothers, Shimon and Levi, go out and come up with this plan where they basically trick the people of Shechem into circumcising themselves. And then on the third day, which according to the Torah is the weakest day after circumcision, Shimon and Levi go in and they slaughter all the men of Shechem, right? It's this kind of really difficult experience. Yaakov gets really upset. He gets afraid and also upset that they took retribution without consulting him. Just in the context of that, if you read the verse itself, it says on the third day, "Vayhi b'yom ha'shlishi b'yotam ko'avi," and this is source two, the third day when the Shechemites, I don't know what the right word for that, were in pain, "Vayichu shnei v'nei Yaakov Shimon v'Levi, achi dina ish charbo," that they, the two brothers, the two sons of Yaakov, Shimon and Levi, the brothers of Dina, each man, ish charbo, took their sword. And there seems to be this extra word in the verse, which is ish. Ish means man, right? So why does the Torah add this word ish that you don't really need? It could have just said the two brothers of Dinah took their swords, but it says instead each man took their sword. And a bunch of the commentaries actually point out that if you count the years from when they were born, they were both 13. And so what this teaches us is when do you arrive at the status of ish, of him being a man, is when you turn 13, learning from Shimon and Levi. I don't think the rest of the recommendation, I don't think you're supposed to take your sword as a shul and start chopping people's heads off.
I'm sorry, did you say Shimon and Levi were 13 years old?
According to the Midrash, they were 13 years old, and that's why they get the extra title of Ish, of being a man at that point. So that is the quintessential, today I become a man at 13. That's one origin source. There is a suggestion that this is actually just a tradition that Moses got at Mount Sinai, even though it wasn't written down explicitly in the Torah itself. There are some who hold that. But in our Mishnaic sources, the first time we see the idea of 13 is actually a place that distinguishes between boys and girls. So what's the magic age for girls becoming obligated in mitzvot?
12.
Right, so where's the source of that? The source of that is a Mishnah in Nida. Nida is a tractate that often refers to family purity, to women immersing in the mikveh. But in the context of that, in this Mishnah, it also talks about when is a person obligated to tell the truth in a vow. So I'm just going to pause for a second and talk about what is a vow. So a vow is a specific thing in the Jewish tradition. It's when you invoke God's name in a promise or a commitment to do something. Right? So either there's different categories of Nidarim and Shvuot, different kinds of vows and oaths. But basically, two examples would be, one, I'm not going to do this, but let's say I were to say, I, Gershon Albert, in the name of God, promise to walk a dog, right? So that would be one category. You could also, though, say, I, Gershon Albert, in the name of God, promise not to eat any kale, I'm not suing this, but in theory, right? So you could obligate yourself to do X, and you could also prohibit yourself from partaking in Y. But those are two different categories. At what age, if a person actually says that really, do their words hold weight? So that's the question in the Mishnah Nida that we're about to study. Okay? What's that? Great, great. So we're going to get there. Hank, do you want to read part of this Mishnah for us in source 3?
Regarding a girl of 11 years and one day, her vows are examined. For example, she is questioned in order to determine if her vows are valid. At 12 years and one day, her vows stand.
Okay, so we'll just pause there. So if she's 11 in one day, if she's in her 12th year, you have to look into it. We'll find out what looking into it means. Who's looking into this, by the way? So this is not the case of a father revoking a daughter's vow. This is a case of a Beit Din, of a rabbinical court deciding, is this young woman obligated to do what she said she was going to, obligated to fulfill her vow. So from 11 and one day on, the Beit Din examines, right? They look into it. And then keep going, Hank.
I had said at 12 years and one day her vows stand, and we examine her vows for the entire 12th year.
Okay.
Regarding a boy of 12 years and one day, his vows are examined to determine if they are valid. At 13 years and one day, his vows stand. Then we examine his vows for the entire 13th year.
Okay. I'll just pause there. So we see that there's two standards, right? Mm-hmm. There's a standard for girls, which is a younger standard, and there's a standard for boys, which is an older standard. There's this like twilight zone for each of them. There's a year period between childhood and adulthood. It's the year before the bat mitzvah and the year before the bar mitzvah. And it sounds like before a girl turns 11 or a boy turns 12, we're just assuming that they can't be held responsible for their words, right? If they commit to something, we don't really expect them to hold up to it. What are we evaluating during that one twilight year, that one in-between year? What is it that we're actually looking for?
Maturity,
okay. Anything else? Any other suggestions?
Probably, faith or something, maybe?
Faith, okay, yeah.
Responsibility,
great. So now the Mishnah is going to actually tell us what it is that we're looking for during this year. Okay, so Hank, do you want to keep going?
Sure. Prior to this time, 11 years and one day for a girl, and 12 years and one day for a boy, even if they said, we know that in the name we vowed, and in the name we sanctified, their vows are not vows, and the sanctifications are not sanctified properly. After this time, even if they say, we do not know in whose name we vowed, and in whose name we sanctified, their vows are vows, and their sanctifications are sanctified properly.
Okay, so who's the name that we're talking about?
God.
Right, so it's the name of God, right? Because the definition of a vow, there's a difference between promises, that's one category, and vows and oaths is another. Vows and oaths are when you invoke God's name. And so here's the assumption. Up till 11 and a day for a girl or 12 and a day for a boy, we don't really assume that a child really knows when they take a vow that they're promising something to God, right? Past 12 and a day and 13 and a day for girls and boys respectively, we assume without a question, even if they were to later come and say, oh, I didn't know who that God person was, not person, that God was, then after the bar bat mitzvah, we don't believe them. We say, you're old enough, you should know, right? We hold you responsible. And during that in-between time, it depends on the individual, right? But that, which is like an interesting kind of examination on its own. I think we see I'll highlight one difference we see. It's assumed that girls intellectually are more developed than boys, right? That's what this Mishnah is assuming itself, right? There's some additional spiritual awareness that girls have. Anecdotally, I think often, not always, but often in the religious world, girls have a spiritual awakening at younger ages than boys. Rabbi Dardik had shared a book with me. I think it's called Faith in Transition. It's about religious development in teenage years. And I think the evidence tends to show that girls are more religiously motivated at younger ages in their teenage years than boys are, and boys kind of catch up later. It's been my anecdotal experience also. I think girls tend to be more religiously motivated in high school than boys are. And so one thing here we're seeing is maybe that there's a younger age for spiritual growth for girls. Another one that I think the Mishnah is assuming is that there's an intellectual awareness, right? Because we're very much concerned that these children know what they're talking about, know in whose name they are swearing and taking vows. So it sounds like in our tradition, girls are assumed to both mature spiritually and intellectually a year younger than boys. Mm-hmm. I'll point out that this is only one half of the story. Sorry, just for now. In a lot of halachic texts, there's a different barometer for knowing if a boy is fully obligated in mitzvot. And that's if they've hit physical maturity. So the Talmud talks about actually have they started growing facial hair and body hair. But we don't normally go around checking that. I think that's a bad idea. Don't go checking the puberty status of children. That's a quick way to get. Yeah, especially if you're a rabbi. And so we generally, an interesting point though, is we generally assume, right, that 13 is the age at which boys have hit some form of physical maturity. And there's actually a few mitzvot that we don't let 13-year-old boys do, that when there's a mitzvah that is considered biblical and is a requirement for the whole community, then often we will not allow a 13-year-old boy to do it. I had this question for the first time this year. There's Torah reading. When we read the Torah, is that a biblical obligation or a rabbinic obligation? It's a rabbinic obligation. Who instituted Torah reading?
Really?
Yeah. The Torah is the Bible, right? But the obligation to read it at regular junctures is rabbinic. Right? So we know that Ezra, who led the return to Israel after the first exile to Babylon, Ezra established, according to the Talmud, that the Torah should be read on Monday mornings, on Thursday mornings, and on Shabbat afternoons. The Torah reading on Shabbat morning is a debate. Some assume that it was actually Moses himself said to do it, some people say. But in any case, it's Moses and not God. Right, so we assume the Torah reading is rabbinic, with one exception, possibly two. The Parsha, where we're told to remember to... the Parsha Zachor, the Parsha where we're supposed to remember what Amalek did to us in the desert, that they came up from behind and they tried to destroy us right as we were leaving Egypt, when we were tired and weary. The Torah says, Zachor, right, remember that which Amalek did to you. And that's a biblical commandment. And the Talmud says, how do you remember it? By reading it. And so that's actually a biblical obligation, is to read that parsha. And we fulfill that obligation the Shabbat before Purim every year in synagogue. So it's actually one of those things, like, if you're going to come to shul one Shabbos a year, that's actually the one to do it. And because it's a biblical obligation, we don't allow a recent bar mitzvah to read that parsha, to read the parsha of where we remember what Amalek did to us. Because just in case, they haven't reached the physical signs of puberty yet. Even though we'll let them read the Torah, we'll let them lead services, all of those things are only rabbinic in nature, as opposed to reading reading for Zachor, which is biblical. Yeah, Steve, you had a question?
No, I just want to add that in the British common law, females reach the age of maturity before males.
All right.
So that same concept is in the common law.
I wonder, like, if they were aware that that was a principle in Judaism or not.
I have no idea.
Okay, cool. So, yeah, Pauline, go ahead. Pauline, you wanted to share something?
No, I just wanted to, it has now passed and it has been opened up.
Yeah.
About these ages, 12 for girls and 13 for boys, does that have to do with physical
puberty?
Puberty, yeah. Yes.
So I think it's connected. It's connected but somewhat independent also. Which is why for boys, where this in a Talmud this comes up more often, it will allow boys to do many things to fulfill the community's obligation, but not the few communal obligations that are biblical in nature. We will reserve for slightly older teenagers, probably if their voice is dropped or something like that. Okay, which it's just another physical sign of physical puberty. All right, I don't claim to be a biology expert, so I'll hold up on that exact determination. Let's turn the page. Where does the concept of a party come from for a bar mitzvah? Yeah, you can see I... Yes.
So when
I was trying to get away from that. Yeah.
But when they say that we examine, so you're saying they do some sort of determination as to their physical maturity.
No, that's not what examination means there.
What does it mean?
As far as I know, examining there means were they conscious of what they were saying? When they, because a vow is, I swear in the name of God, right? Did they know what that meant? That's my understanding, but I'd have to look into it more.
Okay.
Follow up with me, okay?
Okay.
Thank you. The concept of party, right, which nowadays can be different things, right? It's not, for me, it wasn't at the Ritz-Carlton. It was at Congregation Sharman LeBoker. It was a Shabbat Kiddush where we had some rice and schnitzel, if I remember right. There was Jovain wine. I do remember that also, which I used to think was good wine until I moved to California. The concept of party actually has a biblical root to it as well, which is if you look in last week's Parsha, right, after many years of infertility, Sarah and Abraham have a child, and they celebrate this child, right? This is source 4 on the top of the second page. Uli, do you want to read it for us?
The child grew up and was weaned, and Abraham held a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned.
Right, so Biyom Higamel at Yitzhak, on the day that he weaned or that Yitzhak was weaned. What does weaning mean here? So Higamel is a word that we know in other contexts. Gamal can mean to do kindness, right, and Gamilut Chasadim, to do for others. But it's unclear what it means, and there's actually debate in the Midrash. So the Midrash presents two different choices. You can look at source 5 later on your own time. The first is that he got weaned off of his Yetzer Hara, of his evil inclination. That's when the party took place, when Yitzhak was able to overcome his evil inclination. The second interpretation is much more literal, when he stopped drinking milk. Right? That's what weaning normally means. Maimonides, by the way, has a famous line when he's talking about the father, when he's talking about Abraham. He says that Abraham started to ask questions about God when he was weaned off of his mother's breast. When he was finished breastfeeding, that's when Avram went on to his philosophical journey. Okay, we'll save that for now. I wasn't 3 years old when I started to think about God, as far as I know. That's when I learned my first Uncle Maishi song. So when does a person get weaned off of their evil inclination? When does that happen? So what does it mean to get weaned off of your evil inclination is what the question I think Barrett was suggesting by her facial expression in that moment. So this is one of the coolest midrashim I've found in a long time. And by the way, just before we get there, Rashi's interpretation of when a child stops breastfeeding, Rashi says is at 24 months. So, okay, more or less, you could go a little bit longer if you're lucky, if you don't have twins. But don't tell me where I said that. There's a verse in Kohelet in Ecclesiastes. Kohelet is the book in our tradition that we assume Solomon wrote as an old man when he was old and jaded and cynical. But there's still a lot of wisdom that we get out of Kohelet. There's a tradition that Shlomo Melech, King Solomon, wrote 3 books. He wrote Song of Songs, which is basically a romance when he was a young man. He wrote Mishlei Proverbs as a middle-aged man, and then when he was an old man and had been jaded by life, he wrote Ecclesiastes or Kohelet. So within Kohelet, there's a verse in chapter 4, Tov yeled misken v'chacham. It's better to have a poor and wise child, mimelech zaken uchsil, than to have a king who is old and foolish. Okay, better young, wise better poor, wise child than old, foolish king. Why? Because an old, foolish king, asher lo yada lihi zaher od. Old, foolish kings have forgotten how to be careful about stuff. Is King Solomon talking about himself?
Probably.
Yeah. Right? The amazing midrash that tries to figure out what is going on in that verse.
Skip number 5?
Yeah, I summarize number 5, but you can do it on your own time. So that's the verse in Kohelet. And the midrash on that verse kind of breaks it down word for word. Okay, so let's go through that midrash together. So the first part of the verse, better to have a young, poor child who is wise than an old, foolish king. And so what is the first part of that verse? What is it being referred to as Tov Yeled Misken V'Chacham? Good is a poor, wise child. Ze Yetzer Tov. This is the good inclination. So this is a classic Midrashic concept that every human soul has 2 desires or 2 inclinations. The desire to do good, in this context mitzvot, and the desire to do bad, to think selfishly, to want physical satisfaction. So if you have these 2 opposite inclinations, one pulling you towards materialism, the other pulling you towards spirituality, right? Sometimes, you know, before there was all those, like, movies with the two consciences, right? Little good conscience talking on your right side, bad conscience talking on your left side. There's the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara. So what is the Yetzer Tov? Well, the Midrash continues. Lama nikras shmo yeled? Why is the positive inclination called a child? Ki ein mizdaveg la'adam ela miben shlosh esrei shana ulamala. Because the positive inclination does not get joined, or literally does not get attached, as zivug is a partnership. It doesn't partner together with a person until a person turns 13 years old. That's when you get your positive inclination. Why is it called poor? She'ena kol shomin lo. Like a poor person, most people don't listen to them. Right? So you have, at some point, you turn 13, you get this positive inclination, and if you're lucky, once in a while, you listen to what it's saying. Okay. V'lama nikra shmo chacham. Why is it called wise? Shehu melamen et abriut l'derech yesharah. Because if you listen to it, it teaches you the straight and narrow. It teaches you the proper path to go on. Then, that's part one. What is the foolish old king? That's the Yetzer Hara. That's the evil inclination. Right? V'lama koresh oto melech. Why is it called a king instead of a child? Shakol shomin lo. Like a king, everyone listens to it. Everyone listens to their evil inclination. I don't know. I won't assume that to be true for you. Certainly something I've experienced, right? Every time I open the freezer door and there's a pint of ice cream, right? Everyone hears that voice, right? Like, eat me. And you can all hear it. Why is it called elderly? And this is an interesting midrashic take. Shumiz daveg lo miyaldu tovad ziknato. The voice of the evil inclination is with you from your youngest age to your oldest age. Right? Evil temptations never go away. They might change during your lifetime, right? A 3-year-old might want a tantrum over, I don't know, a cookie, and a 40-year-old might want a tantrum over, I don't know, a car or a career, right? But you always have some kind of evil inclination. Why is it called foolish? Because it teaches you the bad way. It teaches everyone the bad thing to do in life. And then why does the verse end that it does not know how to be careful? And it personifies the evil inclination. That evil inclination, that like little bad voice inside of you, eino yodea kamatsar v'kama yisurin ba'in alav, does not know how many difficulties and challenges come to the world because of it. V'hu eino nizhar mehem. And that voice doesn't care. It's not concerned about all the bad things it brings along with it. Okay. So fascinating midrash, right? That kind of gives voice, it personifies those two inclinations or those two voices within us, right? What's interesting, though, is that the Midrash says, what age do you get your positive inclination? At 13. Mm-hmm. If there's something that shifts, right, within a person's neshama, within their soul, right, within their thought process, it gives them a second voice, right, a second way to think about things. Maybe you could think about this. This is the moment in a person's life when they start to be able to look at things from different angles. Right, and the first inclination, which is always the me, right, starts to get tempered by, well, there's another way to look at this, or how is this going to make other people feel, right? That starts, it joins together with you when you turn 13, maybe for girls when they turn 12. So there's some shift, right? That's not just about, not necessarily about spirituality. It's about who said maturity before, right? Jerry. Sure. So it's the maturity of being able to realize that there are multiple ways to look at things. Or you have two voices inside of you. That it's not all about you, right? That sometimes your first desire isn't the best desire. And what I think this goes back to, well, what age did Yitzchak get weaned at, right? So we said he got weaned when he overcame or when he weaned off of his evil inclination. Right? So maybe it doesn't mean that he was cut off from his evil inclination entirely, but maybe it means that he started to balance out that evil inclination with a positive inclination as well. Okay?
No.
So that's the opening source for the idea of being matured at 13. But what does Avraham do when Yitzchak gets matured at 13? Throws him a party. Right? There's actually a biblical source for having a bar mitzvah party. Right? If you take that midrashic view. Right? What does Avraham do on the day that Yitzchak gets weaned, and now we're going to go with the interpretation that it's him gaining his positive inclination, right? It's him turning 13, getting that level of maturity. You throw him a party. It's actually, I never realized this. Like, there's a midrashic view that that is what Avram did. He threw Yitzchak a bar mitzvah party. Yishmael gets a bris party, which is probably a little less fun, years earlier, and when he turns 13, and Yitzchak gets a bar mitzvah party. So, yeah, so that's a midrashic tradition. But let's now turn to the halachic sources for a moment to understand that. So in a chapter in Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law, this is source 8, which is talking about when you can say the blessing of Shechianu. The Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Cairo, who wrote the Sephardic Code of Law in the 1550s, he starts to talk about if you haven't seen someone in a long time, then maybe you can say the blessing of Shechianu. Blessed are you, God, who brought us to this auspicious time, right? And then he says, well, you know what? Probably better not to do it, at least if you know that they were alive. If you were corresponding by letters, don't do it. Okay, that's all the original context. We know that Rabbi Moshe Isserles wrote a gloss to the Shulchan Aruch. Right? He wrote a side commentary that has later been plugged in clause by clause. He's normally known as the Ramah, which is an acronym, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, and that's what we're going to learn here. So in that clause, he says that, by the way, there's another blessing that you make on seeing certain people, including when a father sees his son the day that his son turned 13. Has anyone heard the bracha that's made into bar mitzvah? Alice's like raising her hand. Right. It's one of the most interesting blessings. And what's interesting, by the way, is that not everyone does it. It's actually a matter of minhag. It's a matter of custom whether you say this blessing or not at a bar mitzvah. Let's open the words here. The Ramah opens his words with Yesh Omrim, there are those who say, right, which means that it's not in a universally accepted practice. So there are those who say that Mishana Asab no bar mitzvah, when a person's son, here it's probably talking about a father's son, turns bar mitzvah, what's the blessing? If you're looking at the Hebrew and you see a bunch of acronyms that make no sense, in this source, in source 8, it's actually the opening words of every blessing. Bet Aleph Yod is Baruch Ata Hashem. Aleph Memhei Elokeinu Melech HaOlam. Often traditional halachic sources were all acronized. Is that a word? Acronized? Acronymized?
It is now.
All right. Acronymized. So what do you say? Blessed are you, God, King of the universe. Shiptarani Me'on Sho Shelzeh. Thank you, God, for exempting me from this guy's punishment. Right? Isn't that a crazy blessing? So, okay, great. If my son, when he was 12 years old, got a lighter and a can of deodorant, which may or may not have happened when I was like 10 years old, right? And I think at my 10th birthday party, it was probably 12 because deodorant was starting to be introduced. I wasn't the worst kid in the world, but my mother had a budgie, one of those little birds in the house, and somehow my friends and I thought it was going to be fun to... Clearly, there were not so many teenage boys in this room at some point in their lives. If you take a lighter and then you pour you spray deodorant past it, it creates a fireball. And so then at my 11th birthday party, my friends thought it would be fun to try to burn the bird. They didn't succeed, fortunately. But anyways, let's use that as an example, that a bunch of 11-year-old boys, right, get a little crazy and they burn down, right, someone's house. Who's responsible for the damages? Dad, right? Mom, dad, right? The parents. But according to halacha, once the boy turns 13, right, it's their responsibility, not the parents anymore. So the blessing is, thank you, God, for letting me off the hook. Right?
But interesting. At 12, he wasn't going to be responsible.
At 12, the boy's not, and the parents are.
Yeah.
The parents still are.
13, the boy is not.
13.
Yeah, but remember, he only does the juvie part.
Right. Okay, so, right, we may not get like the worst of the punishments, right? But it's not are the parents responsible for the well-being of the child? Of course. But do they get the punishments that the child would incur on their behalf? Not necessarily. So that's what this blessing is saying, okay? And if you look at the original sourcing of it, it's from the Maharil. The Maharil was a compiler of early German customs in the 11th and 1200s. So this is an old blessing, okay? Blessed is God who exempted me from this person's punishment. Okay, and v'tov levarech below shem u'malchut. The Ramah is saying, because not everyone agrees to make this blessing, the Ramah's suggestion is, if you do make it, don't put God's name in. We have a principle that when you have a doubt about blessing, safek brachot lehakel. If you have a doubt about whether to make a blessing, you should be lenient, and leniency means that you don't say it with God's name. So Jay's now going to look at the sitter, and is going to notice that in the sitter, it does have God's name in it. So the Ramah has not become the be-all, end-all commentary on this. And so many Ashkenaz Jews have the custom to say it with God's name. Are there any...
Actually, it's in parentheses.
In parentheses?
How
okay.
You say it without God's name?
You'll just say Baruch Shepatrani Mi Onshei Shel Zeh. Blessed is he.
It's in parentheses. So
blessed, it becomes basically, blessed is the one who exempted me from this punishment, as opposed to using God's name in it. Okay? I don't think Sephardic Jews make this blessing. Do you know, Yossi? I don't think so either. Because, and how do I know that? Because this is only written in the Ashkenaz commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. But the fact that it didn't make it into the Shulchan Aruch itself, for me, implies that Sephardic Jews don't make this blessing. It's actually kind of a cruel blessing. And when we get to the topic of bat mitzvahs, no one suggests that you make it for a girl, that you make this blessing for a girl. I don't know if it's the assuming that like maybe the average girl is less likely to light fires and get their parents in trouble. I don't know. I'll let you know when I have a teenage daughter. I'm told it's something to look forward to. All right. The Mishnah Berurah writes a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch and on this comment of Rabbi Yosef Cairo, Rabbi Moshe Isserles. It's the top of the next page, source 9. And he explains the custom here of why you make the blessing. And he specifically points to when you make the blessing. So we're going to see in this comments of the Mishnah Berurah how a lot of our modern customs emerge around bar mitzvah. Miriam, would you like to read source 9? The translation is mine, so if it's bad, I apologize.
This is when he turns 13 in one day.
And that's referring to when you say the blessing. So you don't make it before 13 in one day. You make it the day. So it's really, right, it's really the first day of your 14th year. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Your actual birthday,
so it's your actual birthday because you've been alive for another 13 full calendar years, as opposed to making it right the last day of your of when you're 12. Which is your 13th year.
So it's the,
right, so it's
your 14th year.
The beginning, the first day of your 14th year, exactly. Yeah, so that's when you make the blessing,
yes.
Okay.
And now the custom is not to say the blessing until the time that the youth prays with the community as the leader, or when he reads from the Torah on the first Shabbat. Since then, it becomes known to the masses that he is a bar mitzvah.
So we'll just pause there. And so many of the modern customs, right, Getting aliyah from the Torah, right? Possibly leading the service on the Shabbat of your bar mitzvah Shabbos, which is kind of a made up construct on some level, right? When Yitzchak turned bar mitzvah, he didn't read from the Torah, right? In the times of the Tanaim, in the times even of the rabbis of the Mishnah, right? We don't have any custom. There's no Mishnaic or Talmudic text that you have to read from the Torah, that you have to get an aliyah, right? These are all just signs to show the community. Right now that this boy's turned 13, he can get an aliyah, right? And because we want to publicize it, therefore we publicize it in order that people understand the context of that blessing. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So the modern customs emerge as a way to make sure everyone knows why the blessing is being made, which is interesting. Yeah, Jerry.
But this says that your bar mitzvah is the first Saturday following your 13th birthday.
Right. So technically, your bar mitzvah, when you become obligated in mitzvot,
yes,
is when you turn 13. The day you turn 13.
And the first Saturday.
First Saturday after is a night, is a recommended time for doing this, because then the whole community is there and everyone can acknowledge.
It's not a Torah.
It's not an obligation. This is a publicity stunt, right? That's exactly what it is.
Uh-huh.
It's a publicity stunt so that when the dad makes the bracha, everyone knows why. Which is interesting. And by the way, it's important to remind kids of that, because kids start, and I think sometimes kids, because of their parents, start to think that, like, if I don't read my Torah portion, if I don't do all 7 aliyot, if I don't do, like, the Torah and the Haftorah and the Musaf, right, and the Drash, like, I'm not a real man, right? Like that. But that's kind of made up. It's nice if you can do it, right? But if you can't, right, just take an aliyah, right?
But how about many within the more traditional community, they do it on a Thursday. This says only on a Saturday.
Yeah, he gives two options, right? If you look at the language there, it's either, right? He's saying now the minhag has developed,
so
right? The custom is
developed.
This is all minhag, mm-hmm. Yeah. This is all custom. None of this is law. Which is an important distinction,
yeah.
Right? Minhags are nice, right? But they're not requirements. And I think that's an important context also. So whenever I meet with a bar or bat mitzvah, right? I ask them, what does it mean to become bar or bat mitzvah? And they start to say, not all the time, sometimes they'll say, oh, it's when I read from the Torah, or it's when I give my drash in public, or it's when I do my women's mincha, right? And I always tell them, no, it's really the day that you turn 12 or 13 when you are taking on the responsibility for your own relationship with Hashem. That's what a bar mitzvah is. Everything else is window dressing, right? Okay, Miriam, on that note, just keep reading because we're going to see some of the other customs develop. And then Jeff will take your question.
There's a mitzvah for a man to make a meal on the day when his son becomes a bar mitzvah, like the day that he enters under the chuppah, and this is on the day that he enters into his 14th year.
Right, so Vered, you said this before, right, that there's a connection between a wedding and a bar mitzvah, so that this is an acknowledgement of that connection, right, that it's just, what's the connection here? We have a concept of sudat mitzvah, of a festive meal that you make in the context of performing a mitzvah. So we know that that concept exists. The meal after a wedding is called the sudat mitzvah. It's a celebratory mitzvah meal. And so too, a bar mitzvah is a mitzvah meal. So that's where the connection comes, that just as you honor a couple when they get married with a special meal, you should honor a bar mitzvah with a special meal as well. So that's the origin of that connection. Okay.
The reason for this meal is because now he's made into a man in Israel who is commanded in the mitzvot of the Torah. And if this youth expounds, then...
Basically, if he gives it to bar Torah.
Then yeah. It is a mitzvah meal, even if it isn't the day itself.
Okay. So, like, there's two different options here, right? Either you can do the special meal, right, on the day in which the boy turns 13, right, or in his 14th year, so that's really, the full 13 years in a day, right? Or if you can't do it that day, you can still make a special meal as long as there's the bar mitzvah's teaching Torah to the community, right? Because that itself is a celebration. Why is it? It's a recognition that now this boy is obligated in Torah study, right? Just like an older adult is. And from that point, and that's a celebration. Just taking advantage of that obligation, of that opportunity to study and teach Torah is a mitzvah. And therefore you can honor it with a mitzvah meal, with a sudat mitzvah. Okay.
As long as you have a bar Torah, something related to...
As long as the child gives into bar Torah.
Yeah.
As long as exactly. So here, you know, what's being really clearly emphasized, and this is how the customs developed, is that we want showings that the bar mitzvah is appreciating their responsibility of performing mitzvot, right? So all of the window dressings are just different ways to do that, right? Either they're showing that they want to read from the Torah, or they're showing that they want to lead services because they are now obligated in dominating those services. Or they want to teach Torah to the community, right? Because now they're obligated in studying Torah. They're not a child. It's not just education. It's not just practice. It's not just training wheels. Now they're obligated in study for its own sake as adults. So there's a really close association. And I think this is important for parents and children themselves to be reminded of, which is that a bar mitzvah is not a party. Right, it's not a sweet 16, right? It's not about birthday cakes and candles, right? It's about taking responsibility, right? Bar and bat mitzvah means a child of the mitzvot. It's taking responsibility for those mitzvot themselves. And so the window dressing is nice as long as it speaks to that value, right? Jeff, and then we'll go on to the more controversial part.
I was very surprised when I went to Rabbi Ferris's son's bar mitzvah. How little they did compared to in our synagogue. I mean, I expected them to lane and do. I mean, he did lane, but very little. He did the prayer. He got an aliyah and very little.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's normal.
Yeah.
But it seems like if you know, as long as they get an aliyah and read, that's good enough.
Right.
And as compared here, the kids do.
The kids do a lot, yeah.
A lot more. Is that normal? I mean,
so it's actually a good segue to our next topic, which is bat mitzvahs. And here's where we talk about Judaism and sociology, and how, as Rabbi Abram Joshua Heschel had a book, No Religion is an Island, right? Mm-hmm. And I think there's an important realization that traditions develop in the context in which the people who make them live, right? Mm-hmm. So people who are very connected to the way that Judaism was practiced in Europe, but there were no big parties for anyone, for any little, like any teenager in Europe, especially in Eastern Europe, where people were generally poor, right? There wasn't a lot going on. And so because of that, the bar mitzvahs weren't such a big deal either, right? But now that we live in relatively affluent times, right, the average, right, medium income in the United States is probably multiple times higher than whatever an average person in the European shtetl was making before. And so that affects the way we practice our Judaism. And to deny that, right, would be like to deny the reality of how history happens. Right, no, Jewish practices are influenced by the surroundings in which we live. Okay, and so with that in mind, let's talk about bat mitzvahs. Okay? So it's very clear, we saw that Mishnah earlier, right, that at 12 and a day, right, a Jewish girl becomes obligated to mitzvot, takes on the responsibility for vows and for performing mitzvot as well. But what about celebrating that? So let's back up, and if you'd like to do more reading on your own time, you can. The concept of a bat mitzvah is an incredibly modern concept in the course of Jewish history, right? The concept of a bar mitzvah party is also very modern, right? Like, I don't think it was unusual. My dad would be 69 now, and when he was bar mitzvah, I guess 47 years ago or 46 years ago, right? It was schnapps and herring and sponge cake, maybe herring. I'm not sure about the herring. So that was all he had, and I don't think that was abnormal for his time. So everything that we're talking about is fairly modern. And where does bat mitzvah emerge from? So historically, we know that the first American bat mitzvah was Judith Kaplan on March 18th, 1922. So that's 96 years ago?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, in the span of 3,500 history, that's not so... 3,500 year history, that's not so long. Anyone recognize the name Kaplan?
Mordechai Kaplan.
Right, so she is the daughter of Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan, who was the founder of the Reconstructionist movement of Judaism. Right, Mordechai Kaplan himself is a fascinating figure because he was born and raised as a modern Orthodox rabbi. He was ordained by JTS, Jewish Theological Seminary, at a time when Jewish Theological Seminary was basically Orthodox. He was the rabbi of some of the most prestigious Orthodox synagogues in Manhattan, including Kehillat Jeshurun, KJ. Sounds familiar,
yeah.
Right? He was the rabbi of the Jewish Center on the Upper West Side, which is, yeah. And in 1921, he was deemed too progressive or too controversial. He left the Jewish Center, and he founded, I think, the Center for the Advancement of Judaism. I could be getting that title wrong. And that became the flagship center of Reconstructionist Judaism that he founded in 1922, just a few months before his daughter's bat mitzvah. And so if you want to read about it, it was featured. Judith Kaplan had her bat mitzvah. She did not read from the Torah. She read from a chumash at the end of the Torah reading and made a bracha on that reading. So just like an interesting kind of construct in and of itself.
Baby step.
I guess so. And it was extremely controversial. Orthodox rabbis started writing op-eds against her father. It was deemed very, very much controversial. What's interesting is that bat mitzvahs did not become commonplace in the Reform movement. They became basically very closely associated with the conservative movement. Why wouldn't Reform Jews want a bat mitzvah? Bat mitzvahs didn't become popular in the Reform movement until the 70s and maybe even the 80s, which is interesting. In the 50s, it became very common in conservative and conservadox spaces. We'll talk about that later. Beth Jacob is probably on the earlier side of allowing girls to have bat mitzvahs in shul. We'll get there in a few minutes. So if you want to look at this really interesting academic article, source 12, How Bat Mitzvah Became Orthodox, by Rabbi Zev Elif and Menachem Butler. These are two people who are acquaintances of mine, and I think they're kind of on the... Rabbi Zev Elif wrote a documentary history of modern orthodoxy that is excellent. I looked for my copy this morning, and I couldn't find it, so I had to email him, and he sent me a copy of this essay. And if you actually just read source 12, Jeff, do you want to read it just quickly?
By and large, Reformed Judaism in this period ignored bat mitzvah, dismissing it as a form of Orientalism out of touch with Western culture. Besides, Reformed congregations much preferred confirmation ceremonies, a public religious examination of 16 to 18-year-old boys and girls, typically held in children.
Okay. So, and he says that went back to 19th century Europe. So he says in 1950, right, virtually all Reformed congregations hosted confirmation, while just a quarter of them observed some form of bat mitzvah. So it was very uncommon in the Reformed community at that point. And yet we know during the interwar years, conservative congregations had also adopted confirmation. You know, I think Temple Beth Abraham, if I'm not mistaken, still does confirmation. So confirmation was a reform idea that came from Germany, probably influenced by the church. A lot of classic Reform Judaism are kind of adaptions of things that happened in Protestant churches in Germany, right? So like the idea of a choir, right? The idea of having an organ, but the idea that the bima was moved from the middle of the synagogue to the front of the synagogue, that the rabbi, aka the priest, or influenced by the priest, faced the congregation as opposed to facing towards the bima, right? All of these things were adaptations from churches in Germany in the 18 and 1900s. So the conservative movement had kind of taken it on, and even they distanced, not that they distanced from bat mitzvahs, they took on confirmation as the rite of passage for boys and girls. And the idea of Orientalism is the thinking that Reform Judaism is based in the concept that German culture is high culture, right? And a lot of things that were Jewish beforehand were Orientalism. Those were Middle Eastern things. They're not high cultured, right? So boys and girls, 12, 13 years old, becoming adults, those were the old timers, but they didn't really know well. So like we know, we're going to follow the customs of our lands, right? We're people of citizens of Germany. And so if in the church they're getting confirmed at 16 or 18, we're going to do that too, okay? So there's a movement away from bar mitzvahs, probably bar mitzvahs, and certainly bat mitzvahs, there was not a great desire for them. However, the conservative movement very much held onto the concept of bat mitzvah. And slowly but surely, there's a lot more in common between conservative Judaism and Orthodox Judaism, right, than between Reform and Orthodox. So what is it that brought bar and bat mitzvahs to the Orthodox world? Just historically, if you want to look into it later, some of the earliest synagogues that did this in New York was KJ, Kilo Jeshurun, when Rabbi Haskell Lookstein did four bat mitzvahs followed by his daughter's bat mitzvah in 1972. Soon after, Rabbi Riskin, who was at Lincoln Square Synagogue, these names might be familiar to people, Rabbi Riskin later went on to found the town of Efrat in Israel, which is a 30,000 people town now, just outside of Jerusalem. And so he did one soon after that in the early 1970s as well. So we know that it was basically an adaptation in Orthodoxy that came from mostly conservative Jews. It was fought tooth and nail about in the 1970s and 80s, and going back earlier as well. So what I want to pause and think about for a minute is why were many Orthodox rabbis deeply opposed to the idea of a bat mitzvah?
Well, I think it would have to do with your earlier comment about religion and sociology. Orthodoxy would think of itself as counter to the prevailing culture.
Yeah.
I think it's part of our underlying dynamic.
Great. So I would actually say Orthodoxy, part of it is that it's a movement created in opposition. I think that's what you're saying. Orthodoxy means, on some levels, not being unwilling to change.
Right.
Right. I think that's the definition of the word Orthodox. So I want to talk a little bit about the history of Orthodoxy. I think there's a book by Mark Shapiro called How Orthodoxy Rewrites Its History, which is an interesting title and thought in and of itself. So the construct of a movement known as Orthodoxy, right, was just created in the shadow of the construct of a movement called Reform. Right. Right, there was a period of time where there was Judaism, and there were different streams of it, mostly geographic-based. Right, if you lived in Morocco, you practiced a little bit different than if you lived in Yemen, or if you lived in Babylon, or you know, what would later become Iran and Iraq, or Syria, right, or Italy, right, or Greece, or Western Europe, Eastern Europe. Like every geography had its own unique sets of customs, but writ large, right, it was a uniform, accepted practice. Right, most Jews kept Shabbat in a fairly similar way until, let's say, the mid 1700s. Okay, so with that in mind, here's like my kind of understanding of modern Jewish history. Right, I did a whole class about this, and I'll just repeat it in brief. Right, Western European Jews are presented with the idea of emancipation and becoming citizens of their countries. And with that possibility of becoming a citizen of Germany, of England, of France, right, they became a deep desire to want to assimilate or acculturate and become like the people of those countries. So that leads to the birth of Reform Judaism, right, where you're basically shape-shifting Judaism to fit into the cultures in the countries in which you live. Okay, so that's movement. The pendulum swings in one direction, right? In contradistinction to that, right, is a pullback in the opposite direction. If Judaism is starting to be reformed and to be forced to change, there's an opposite movement that says we don't want Judaism to change ever again, right? And that's what we would nowadays call ultra-Orthodoxy, right, writ large. There's a phrase by one of the founders of what we would now call the ultra-Orthodox movement, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, who wrote important responsa literature that we still study today, called he's known as the Chatam Sofer, and he borrowed a Mishnaic term and reapplied it, and his term was Chadash Asur Min HaTorah. That Chadash, by the way, was a kind of grain that you're not supposed to eat before the second day of Passover. We'll talk about that another time. But he borrowed that term and said Chadash, anything new, is forbidden by the Torah. Can't make any changes. There's a reason why Haredi, ultra-Orthodox, and Hasidic Jews today dress like Polish peasants of the mid-1800s, right? It was a freeze button, right? It was pressing pause on whatever customs had developed up to that point and said, we're not going to change anything anymore, right? We don't want it to move at all. And that tendency, right, of defensiveness, right, of isolationism, right, basically says that any time anything new is introduced, right, like feminism, right, like the desire for girls to have ceremonies similar to the ones that boys have, right, there's a tendency in Orthodoxy, specifically from part of Orthodoxy, that says, sorry, that's new, it doesn't exist, we're not going to allow it. Right? Why can we not have a bat mitzvah? Because we never had a bat mitzvah before. Right? And there, you know, you'll see streams of this in halachic literature today. Right? This is coming up in the debate about female clergy in Orthodoxy, right? Where there's one word that's thrown out, and it can kind of become the trump card, no pun intended. And the word that's thrown out is misora, right? Misora means tradition. Tradition. Basically, if it's not what we've already done, if it's not something we've already done, there's no way that we can start to do it. And that is a strong pseudo-halachic argument that can be pulled, right? Orthodox Judaism believes that Jewish practice changes very slowly and deliberately and doesn't take these great jumps and leaps. And so there is what to say in the Orthodox traditions around that idea of Misora, that we don't change our traditions quickly, we change them very slow and deliberately. Other problems as well that face the idea of confirmation, of bat mitzvahs. There are those who feel that the idea of a girl having a coming-of-age ceremony is something being borrowed from Christianity. Okay? That it has nothing to do with Reform Judaism, it's being borrowed from a non-Jewish practice. I think this might be a reference to Sweet 16, or I don't know to what degree Protestant churches had confirmation ceremonies. I think that there is a concept of confirmation for girls that exists in Christianity. There's a biblical verse that says, "Uvechukotehem lo telechu," which means do not walk in the ways of the nations. That Jewish practice should be separate and distinct and uninfluenced by non-Jewish practice. This goes so far. Have you ever noticed that Hasidim don't get married inside synagogues?
Right.
They'll only get married outdoors. Mm-hmm. Has anyone been to a Chabad wedding?
Yes.
So that is a relatively modern construct. Hasidim only get married outdoors. This is because in Hungary, in the 1600s, if I'm not mistaken, 100 rabbis sign a letter saying that Jews always, from time immemorial, got married in shuls, inside the sanctuary. However, now the church has started marrying its couples inside sanctuaries. Therefore, we cannot follow in the ways of the Gentiles. We have to be different. We're now only going to get married outside. 100 rabbis signed this letter and said that it's no longer permitted to get married inside shuls because that's what the Christians are doing.
Now, okay? Now it's going to happen now with the non-Jews are going to get married outside. Where?
We'll have to come back inside, yeah. Akhtay Kach, it goes that far. There are those who say that you shouldn't, here's a strong argument. Rabbis should not wear robes, right? The Reform movement borrows the idea of a robe for clergy from the church. And Orthodoxy, specifically ultra-Orthodoxy, is extremely opposed to that. Right? Saying you can't borrow from non-Jewish communities in deciding how you practice. Right? Sometimes you have to even do the opposite. Right? So maybe there's an argument.
But all those Catholic guys wear the kippahs on their heads.
So maybe we should stop wearing kippahs. The argument would go. Okay. There would be an argument for that. this is a very quick summation of a very long, so again, we could spend five classes talking about that topic alone. However, in the halachic writings that emerge around bat mitzvahs is the argument that non-Jews do it, therefore we cannot. Okay? This is probably the most interesting one sociologically, is that the proximity between Orthodoxy and conservative Judaism in the 1950s created an extremely strong desire on behalf of the rabbis of that generation, the Orthodox rabbis, to distinguish themselves from conservative Judaism, right? It's an era in which the lines were much more blurred, right? I'm guessing that in the 1950s, some of the most observant members of Beth Jacob would very happily walk to Beth Abraham and attend services. I'm not sure, but I'm guessing that would have been far more likely back then than it might be today.
The conservative shuls of the 50s and 60s were very similar to Orthodoxy in prayer as far as what they put in service,
yes,
as opposed to Reform, which kind of they had a schism also
within the conservative movement, yes.
But in the 50s, 60s, they were similar other than they were more modernized.
I think it's still similar, except for the Mechitza.
Kind of stuff.
So the prayers have shifted a little bit more, right? Yeah, like the Siddur of the conservative movement has changed
a little bit.
Yeah. There have been
the 50s were pretty much identical.
I think they were identical. And so this actually leads to a lot of concern. Coupling that, so one is that there's a very gray line between Orthodoxy and conservative Judaism. The other part of it is that Jewish sociologists in the 1950s were saying that Orthodoxy would not exist in 10 years, right?
Yeah.
It was the end of Orthodoxy. Ben Gurion, right, made his deal with the yeshiva students, exempting them from army service, because there were only 300 of them who wanted exemption from the army, and he said that in 10 years there won't be any, right? And now there's like 100,000, right? So that was, you know, the wrong hand to play in poker. However, that led to an incredible fear on the Orthodox leadership of that generation about getting swallowed up by the conservative movement. Right, you can think of Beth Jacob as a great example. Right, Beth Jacob was on the precipice of Orthodoxy and conservative Judaism. Right, we were traditional. Right, but traditional was not so different than conservative back then. To Jay's point, right, we didn't have a mechitza back then.
Right.
So because of that, you have poskim like Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and Rav Soloveitchik, who purposely create barriers to differentiate Orthodoxy. Right, and they say that we have to place these barriers. Rav Soloveitchik went as far as to say that if you don't live in any access to an Orthodox synagogue, and your only choice to hear shofar in Rosh Hashanah is to walk into a conservative synagogue, said better not to hear shofar.
Right?
Which is really Rav Soloveitchik. Sorry, I don't want to speak it down because I think this speaks to a historic reality. Right? Orthodoxy was on the defensive, and their approach to defending themselves was to place barriers against that which the conservative movement stood for. Right, so one of those was mechitza, right?
Isn't it true that I was learning that when I was choosing Orthodoxy, they said be careful because they said once you choose Orthodoxy, you're no longer allowed to go back into other shuls because they don't do things differently. Like one of us said, you know, once you convert, you can't pray in a Reform shul, you can't pray in a conservative shul because you are Orthodox.
Sure. So let's talk more about that after, because I just don't want to go on record. But it's an interesting point. So because of the blurring of the lines and the great fear that Orthodoxy would cease to exist, many poskim of that generation in the 1950s and 60s in Orthodoxy placed really strong barriers between Orthodox and conservative Judaism. Mm-hmm. And one of them was the bat mitzvah, right? Was that we're holding the line, that we're not going to innovate, we're not going to certainly adopt a conservative practice, because bat mitzvah was known as a practice of the Orthodox movement. Okay. And so how did things change? So things changed in three ways. One is you had someone like Rav Moshe Feinstein in America who was a very open-minded thinker. That's just one piece, then we'll get to that later. Two is you had one of the greatest post-game of pre-Holocaust Europe who survived the war but lost his entire yeshiva and wrote a few articles about it that got published in America, encouraging the idea of bat mitzvah. Three is in Israel, where there was no reforming conservative movement, bat mitzvahs became a little bit more popular. And you see this trend continuing today. that if something gets adopted in the Orthodox community in Israel, it becomes much more easy to bring it back to the Orthodox community in America. One example of that is female clergy. We can talk about that another time. A last thing that happens, and this is what Rabbi Zev Elof points out, is that while in New York this becomes, you know, the great controversy of the 60s and 70s, in out-of-town Judaism, right, in America's diaspora communities, like probably Oakland and Chicago Cleveland, etc., places that were a little further from the heat, Orthodox communities do start adopting bat mitzvah ceremonies because they realize if you don't bring the girls in, you're going to go somewhere else. And so just to summarize for you Source 13, which is Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberger, he's known as the Sridei Esh, one of the most important post-scheme halachic decisors before the Holocaust. He had a massive seminary in Germany. Then his entire family and yeshiva was killed off, and he went into exile in Switzerland after the war. And he basically stayed there for the rest of his life and just wrote articles and did not have a large group of students after the Holocaust. But he wrote a few articles about bat mitzvah, in which he said something that ironically Rav Soloveitchik said about women studying Talmud, which is, we don't live in the same world that existed in Europe. He's saying this in Switzerland after the Holocaust. He basically says that back in the day, where did young women's Jewish identities form? They formed in home, right? He uses this expression like they drank it in the milk that they were weaned on, going back to like an earlier image, right? But in post-Holocaust Judaism, right, that's not happening anymore. Most girls are going to public schools, right? And if we don't give them an opportunity to proclaim their faith, right, to take ownership of their identities as Jews, right, then we're going to lose them. And he basically uses that as an apologetic for, therefore, it's very important to give girls bat mitzvahs, to give them a way to really proclaim who they are and what they believe in. I would say that logic is probably the most important factor in what normalized bat mitzvahs and orthodoxy, right? First of all, orthodoxy became stronger and stronger. So there was less and less fear about the conservative movement taking over. That, sociologically, we know that to be true, right? The shuls of Manhattan themselves became case studies in proving that you could still be orthodox and be open and modern to the world, right? So KJ, Lincoln Square Synagogue, kind of create new models for modern orthodoxy. Modern orthodoxy develops into what it is today. It's influenced by the thinking of Rabbi Soloveitchik, right, who very much encouraged women to take ownership of their Judaism through high-level Talmud study in the Orthodox community. Like, that's definitely part of the equation also. And so when you have great sages permitting bat mitzvahs combined with out-of-town communities, quote, right, out-of-town doesn't mean San Francisco, out-of-town means New York, starting to take it on anyways, and you have the deep desire to not lose the girls of America from Judaism, it eventually becomes normalized. I think this is, you know, a really interesting case study in how modern orthodoxy functions, right? By the way, today bat mitzvahs are even celebrated in most of the ultra-orthodox community, but that's something fairly recent, probably in the past 20 years. That's much more recent than in the modern orthodox community. You know, orthodoxy is always going to operate on parameters of halacha, right, of looking back to the Shulchan Aruch, to the code of Jewish law, to the commentaries on the code of Jewish law, to the commentaries on the Talmud and the Talmud itself. That's always going to be the basis of how halacha is decided. But then there is a sociological component to how religious choices are being made. And there are different factors, right? There's still, there is an importance of distinguishing orthodoxy as different than other denominations that still plays into the halachic process. Right? You're going to continue to hear the Misorah argument, the argument of tradition being brought up in a variety of cases and situations. So that's still something that's going to be coming up. There's going to continue to be a fear of changing too many things too quickly, right? That's continuing to be part of the process, and it's an intentional part of the process, right? There's an intentionality that because we care so much about our traditions, we don't want to change them quickly at the risk that they'll fall apart entirely. And so moving slowly is actually a deliberate part of that process. And in modern orthodoxy in particular, I think there's a realization that everything outside of orthodoxy is not necessarily evil. And with time, we arrive to those ideas in different ways and through different conduits and channels. But the ideas such as feminism encountering orthodoxy right, is continuing to shape and shift, to reshape itself and to shift with time. And it's done slowly and deliberately, but change does happen. And I think bat mitzvah is an excellent example of from 1922, when there had not been one bat mitzvah in all of America, to 2018, where I don't think there's a single synagogue in at least the modern Orthodox community that doesn't encourage girls from having their own bat mitzvahs as well. So that's my spiel. Happy to take a few questions, and then we'll... Oh, and I did not keep to my time commitment. So I'm going to stop here, and if anyone wants to ask questions after, feel free. Lila, have a great night. Thank you. Yeah.